107.
Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe from joecolantonio.com, and today we're going to be speaking with Mark Collin, the author of the book Mastering Selenium WebDriver. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Mark, welcome to Test Talks.
Hi.
So it's great to have you on the show. Today, I'd like to talk to you about your awesome new book, Mastering Selenium WebDriver. But before we do, can you tell us just a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I'm a tester, basically. I've been doing this for about 15 years now. I got into automation about 6 years ago, and that's when I got into WebDriver. And that's about it, really. I guess I've just carried on from there.
Awesome. So how did you get into actually programming and automation 6 years ago? Was it just part of the job and you just stumbled into it, or is it something you always wanted to do?
I've always liked fiddling with code, and to be perfectly honest, I'm slightly lazy. I don't like doing the same repetitive tasks again and again and again. So automation seemed like an ideal way to be lazy and to also fiddle about with code and tweak with things.
So why did you write Mastering Selenium WebDriver?
I originally got asked by Packet Publishing if I'd like to do a second edition of an existing book. I didn't really like that idea, because if you do a second edition, you start cutting into the original author's royalties, which seems a bit off, really. I wouldn't really want somebody taking my book and adding an extra paragraph and then, you know, taking it away from me, as it were. So I said I wasn't interested in that. And then they suggested I could do my own book. And that's how it happened, really.
So this book covers a lot of more advanced topics. I know there's other books out there for Selenium, but there's things in here that you cover that I don't see in other books, like Maven. So things that may seem simple to someone that's done automation and programming before, but for someone that's kind of new to automation, things like I think concepts like Maven can sometimes cause them problems. So could you just tell us a little bit more about the Maven piece? Why is Maven important, and when would you use it?
Well, Maven, well, in the UK anyway, I've worked in London for quite a long time, and I've worked quite a lot of companies in the UK, and Maven is bread and butter in the Java development community over here. So in all the enterprise software you work on, you'll normally see Maven being used as the build and dependency management system. And there doesn't really seem to be that much out there talking about Maven and using Selenium with Maven. Most of the information out there is very basic, or it doesn't really talk about how you'd do your dependency management or how you'd build things. So it seemed like a good opportunity to put that in, because I hadn't seen it around before.
Yeah, and that's why I was really excited to see it. Like myself, I use Maven with Java, and I always get weird issues like Maven dependency issues and plugin issues, and it's not always as straightforward as you would think. But in your book, you actually start a project from scratch, and you show all the different POM file entries you need to use in Maven in order to get it working. So I found it really helpful.
It's basically something I've been doing for quite a long time, and I've slowly built up a very basic template of getting everything together so that you can just start a new job and dump in a very basic framework quite quickly. And it just seemed like a good thing to put in, really. It seems useful. And if you step through it slowly and tell people how it's done, hopefully they'll be able to understand why certain things are done certain ways, and it'll be useful for them, really. And it's just a good start for everyone.
So what would you say the benefit of Maven is? Is it so right now, if people aren't using a tool like Maven, they have to manually resolve all dependencies every time there's an update. But with Maven, you just update it and it takes care of all the things in the background for you automatically?
Well, the main idea of Maven is you can just check out a project, type Maven clean install, and you're ready to go. It will download all the dependencies. It'll set up your class path. It'll do everything for you. It will create artifacts. It'll create your jars or your wars, depending on what sort of output you're getting from your build. And it'll also run all of your tests. So, you know, you build an entire project, it'll perform all your unit tests. It'll create an artifact that can be deployed to a container. You can then deploy it to a container as part of that build, and you can run all of your Selenium tests against it. So you can be pretty sure that you've got a working bit of software that's well tested, and you don't really need to do anything once it's all configured correctly.
Awesome. And one of the other benefits, I think you've actually written some plugins. So what is the driver binary downloader Maven plugin?
Okay, so that's a little plugin that I created to get around a problem that most people have when they're using Selenium. To get Chrome driver, IE driver, and Opera driver, although that's not used so much anymore, working, you need to download an executable. This executable is basically the layer that talks to the browser. So it talks between the browser and the Selenium bindings. So when you write your Selenium tests, they need to talk to a bit of code that can then talk to the browser and tell it how to do what you're telling it to do, to automate the browser, basically. These executables aren't held in Maven because it's not Java files, basically. It's a standard executable for either Windows or for OS X or for Linux. So because when you do a Maven build, you want everything to just download and work by itself without having to do any manual configuration, I wrote a little plugin that will automatically download these executables and set up the environment variables so that it does just all work. So the idea is that if you're using that plugin with a Selenium framework, you can type a Maven clean install and it will pull everything down for you and run your tests. And you don't need to do the manual configuration on your machine or set up any environment variables on your local machine.
Awesome. And I was really happy to see this plugin also. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm definitely going to. The reason why is I support 8 to 10 Scrum teams. And a lot of times these teams, when they're starting with the framework, they don't remember to pull down the IE driver. Or it's part of, yes. You know, they don't add the environment variable, and I have to troubleshoot, you know, 20 different configurations. So thank you for writing it. I think it's a big help. So that's cool. Another piece is that with Maven, do you know, I've been hearing more and more about Gradle. If someone was starting from scratch, would you still recommend they use Maven, or is it project by project basis, whether or not to use something like Gradle over Maven?
Completely project by project basis. I would recommend you use whatever your team uses. If you've got a lot of expertise in your team using Maven, it makes sense to use Maven, because if you get stuck, you'll like to have someone there who'll understand it and be able to help you out. Exactly the same for Gradle. If you've got a team that's got a lot of people who've used Gradle and know it very well, then why not use Gradle? You know, there's nothing to stop you. I don't see these things as there is one way that you should do it and you shouldn't touch anything else. It's all about using the expertise in your team and doing something that's sensible. If you don't know Gradle at all, it doesn't really make sense to try and use Gradle in your project unless you're trying to learn it. But then I suppose it depends on what you're doing. I do quite a bit of consultancy work, and generally speaking, the clients don't want to pay me to learn something I don't know. So I'd probably go for something that's tried and tested. But if you are in a team where you are all trying to learn something and you want to give Gradle a try, why not?
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's a great answer. If your team's using it, why not use it? But if they're not, why add another extra layer of something that you're going to have to teach everyone else about? So I think it's a great, great answer. So with Maven, can you pass custom parameters? For example, I know I've seen teams that actually create batch files that do this, but I think there's got to be some functionality within Maven that allows you to do a lot of things that people aren't aware of. So are there anything about Maven that you think a lot of people don't know you can do that they do a lot of hacks for?
Well, Maven's quite powerful. You can pass in variables in the command line when you start Maven up. So if you do like a minus D, a variable name, you can set a value for a variable that's passed into the Maven build process. So in the book, I think I'm using passing in Maven command line variables to set which sort of driver you want to use. So you can switch your driver from Firefox to Chrome driver or IE driver using a command line attribute. Maven also supports profiles, which are really useful. So you can profile away your Selenium tests so that by default, your Selenium tests won't run on a standard Maven clean install. But if you add a profile like a minus P Selenium tests, if you've hidden your Selenium test behind a Selenium test profile, when you specify that profile, it'll run the Selenium test as well. So that gives you a way to give your build different abilities depending on where it's running. So if you're running your build on your local machine, you might want to run everything. Whereas if you're running from the build server, you might want to cut down the build and only run certain parts at a time. So you might want to break your initial build of your unit test into the first step, and then the second part of your build where you do the integration tests or the Selenium tests as a separate phase.
Awesome. Actually, that's actually, once again, functionality I wasn't aware of. And that's really great, because one of the questions I was going to ask you is, in your experience, do you usually recommend that developers run the whole test suite? Or do you do something like you create a profile and you only run maybe half the tests? What would you recommend for that particular process to developers? Do they run the whole entire test suite, or do you usually just have them run particular features that you know are being affected within this particular sprint that they might be working in?
I think they should always run the whole thing.
Wow.
Continuous integration is there to make sure that things work, but you shouldn't be checking in code that you're not sure if it works or not, really. I see continuous integration as a safety layer. If it works on your machine, we then put it onto the CI box to see if it works on your CI environment, because your CI environment should be similar to your production environment, really. So I use a Mac for doing my work. So if I can build my stuff on a Mac, that's great. But if the code that I've been building and testing on my local Mac is actually put in a Linux box, that's where you'd have a CI server that's running in Linux. So that would just tell you if there's any weird things that are going on that works on OS X but doesn't quite work on Linux. Or say for Windows, if you're using Windows here as dev box, it might work fine on Windows, but when you put it into a Unix-based environment, there might be a couple of quirks that you're not quite sure about. So I see that as the point of CI. It's a safety layer. If you're constantly breaking the build, I think you're probably not doing it right. We don't want builds that are always broken. We always want working code, because broken builds slow people down. If I break the build, somebody's got to go and find out why the build's broken. There shouldn't be anyone committing on that build, because if we commit on a broken build, we don't know if we're breaking something else. It's bad practice, really, to not run your tests. I do see people not running all of their tests all the time, and that's normally because they've written so many tests that the build process takes a very, very long time. So you'll see some legacy apps where people have done a lot of end-to-end testing, and the build process will take maybe 2 hours for them to actually run all of their tests. That's a bad thing. You shouldn't have a build process that's 2 hours long. If you've got a build process like that, you need to have a look at what you're doing, because you've probably got far too many end-to-end tests. It's probably worth getting rid of some of those end-to-end tests that aren't useful and moving them down into the unit testing layer.
So that's a great point, and that's actually something I've been struggling with for a while. Like I said, I work for a large company, and for some reason we use behavior-driven development, but they have to have a feature file and a scenario for each requirement, so they have each one as a requirement. So we have thousands of tests, and it takes 8 to 9 hours to run. And it's not really sustainable, like you said, because people can't run it on locally because it takes forever and no one knows how to build up these environments, and it's just a nightmare. And when I try to tell them, hey, let's do more unit tests, more integration tests, it's always a struggle to say, well, no, that's not how our users are going to use the application. So I know you have a whole chapter within your book on creating faster feedback loops. So do you have any do you have any tips on how to get around this particular issue or issues like this?
I guess really showing people various talks by other people in the community. JB Rainsberger does a brilliant talk about why integration testing is a scam. And he basically talks through what you're trying to do if you're doing integration tests, which is basically you're taking the outside layer of a program and you're trying to exercise every internal path through the outside layer. Now, to do that through the outside layer is very, very hard. You've got to come up with hundreds and hundreds of different scenarios to try and hit all of these different paths in your code, and you're probably not going to manage to do it. If you can move those scenarios inside the actual code and do them as unit tests, you can do a lot of testing on specific functions and hit all of these different paths. And you don't need as many tests to do it, because you're breaking them down into smaller, easily manageable chunks. I think that's the way to go, really. I mean, there's always going to be a case to have some end-to-end tests, but really, end-to-end tests should just be checking that a major functional path works. A good example I see quite a lot is when people write Selenium tests, they spend a lot of time checking the text on a page. I don't think you should ever do that, really. You should have a test that checks that however you're putting your text on the page works. But once we know that that mechanism works, there's really not a lot of point in checking what the actual text is, because the text is always going to change. It's one of those things that makes your test brittle and is really a big waste of time.
No, I definitely agree with you. I see this all the time. We have a REST service where it generates the information that's going to be generated in the front end, and people still use the UI to test when they could do a majority of the test against the REST API and get the coverage they need, yet they still go against the UI, so it's a constant battle.
And that's a good point, because if you've got a REST API that's giving you all the text to your front end, it's probably all coming out as a big blob of JSON. It's very easy to do a comparison match with one big blob of JSON and see if all the JSON you're getting is the JSON that's expected. But then if you take that JSON and you pump it into a front end and you use front end tests to try and test each line of text that appears on the page, and you've not just got text that's appearing on the page, you've also got things like alt text for images, pop-up text, titles, you know, all sorts of things. You might even have text for sight readers. A lot of that text you're not going to see on the front end very easily. You can get to it, but it's awkward, and it takes a lot longer to try and do that sort of testing for the front end. It really isn't a good idea, and a lot of people don't seem to realize this.
So, Mark, also, you talk about living documentation. You test as living documentation. What do you mean by that?
I got fed up with people talking about regression tests. So the idea of a regression test is to see what's changed. If we've made some code changes to our program, we know it's changed, so we don't really need a regression test to tell us that it's changed. And when we make our code change, we're obviously going to change the tests that we already have in the system so that they mirror this code change. So really what our tests are doing is it's documenting the behavior of the program. We're not doing a regression test. We're just showing people how our program works. So because of that, that's why I see tests more like documentation. And they're not documentation in the way that it's just a bit of text that people don't have to read. It's living documentation that's constantly changing. As your application changes, your documentation changes with it. And I guess that's what I mean by test as documentation. It's telling you that your program always works in a certain way. It also means that if you make some changes locally and you break some of your tests, it's flagging up that your documentation is wrong. So you need to change those tests, which is in effect changing your documentation, or you can revert your functionality back to the way it should be working, i.e. it matches your documentation.
Cool. And I think a lot of people, for some reason, when they hear living documentation, they automatically assume, oh, we need to use behavior-driven development. And when they do that, they end up using BDD as an automation framework rather than as a collaboration tool. And so they add an extra layer when they could have just created a test in a more readable way and have the benefit of readability that way, rather than having to have an extra layer like BDD to create this.
Well, I mean, BDD, I think, is used as a buzzword by a lot of people who don't really know what it means. Mm. To me, BDD is just having a conversation.
Yep.
That's all it means. Talk to your users, find out what they want. You don't have to use a tool like Cucumber to be doing BDD, for example. You don't need to write all of your end-to-end tests in advance before you write code, which some people seem to think. BDD is just talking to your users and making sure that you're building what they want. I get quite frustrated with BDD a lot of the time because I've come up to quite a few projects where they've got hundreds of spec files for Cucumber. You say, okay, so which business analyst reads this? You know, which of your users read it? Oh, none of our users read it. We just use Cucumber because we want to do BDD.
Oh.
It's really frustrating for me. It's, you know, you've completely missed the point of BDD.
Yep.
And instead you're using a tool to try and say you're doing BDD.
So you also bring up a few points besides BDD of ways to help run tests quicker. And one of them was using Docker with Selenium. So why would you use Docker, or when would you use Docker? Especially when, once again, I have teams that say we only support, you know, officially Windows with Internet Explorer or Firefox. So we would never run against Linux, but it's just a browser anyway. So what would you say to someone about that? Or when would you use Docker? When do you think it's appropriate to use something like Docker?
Okay, so the reason I'd use it for Selenium tests is because setting up a Selenium grid is a pain.
Hmm.
If you want to set up a Selenium grid really quickly, you can do it in Docker. Okay, you've not got Internet Explorer, So if you do want to do some testing on Internet Explorer, you're going to have to manually set up a Internet Explorer agent like you normally would with a grid. It's just a nice quick way to get you started, basically. You'll get yourself a grid hub, and you can get as many Chrome or Firefox agents as you want attached to the grid. So that's why I like Docker for that particular scenario. If we're talking about Docker as part of a tech stack in more detail, I would much prefer people start creating Docker containerized versions of our application as part of their build. If you do that, it makes it really, really easy to test because you just spin up the Docker container and then you can fire your end-to-end tests at that Docker container. If all of your tests pass, you know that your application that's in that Docker container is a good application that you can move down to a different test environment. Now with Docker, because it's a container, you can just take that container and move it anywhere. You can put it into an integration testing environment, a performance testing environment, a staging environment. You can even take that same container and stick it in live. And we've not made any code changes at this point. We're just using exactly the same container with exactly the same application that we used when we started doing our testing. So we know for a fact that what we've tested is the same as what's live. And the other great thing we get from that is that if something goes wrong when it's live, we can just take a copy of that container and we can hand it back to the development team and say, this container went wrong. Here's the actual code as it was running. Have a look and see what you can find wrong with it. And it makes it a lot easier to replicate problems and fix them.
Awesome. And once again, you have a chapter in your book called Hooking Docker into Selenium, and you walk step by step how to do this. I guess the biggest question I should have asked, or the higher level picture, was for someone that doesn't know, what is Docker at a high level?
Docker is kind of like a VM, but it's not a VM. So Linux has the ability to isolate some processes inside a Linux box so that those processes think they're running in a completely isolated way that isn't attached to the rest of the Linux machine. That's basically what Docker does. It hides your processes in a sandboxed area. It's incredibly quick to start up because you're not starting up an entire VM with an entire operating system. You're just starting up a single Linux process.
Very cool. So it sounds like something like, rather than having a physical machine that you have to maintain and over time, you can just create these on the fly, tear them up and tear them down fairly easily.
Yeah, exactly. And you do still have to have a physical machine. You've got to have a machine that runs Docker. But that means you've just got to have a Docker host that you manage rather than the rest of it. That can be good, that can be bad. It depends on right. How much you like Docker, I guess.
And with Docker right now, it only supports Linux, but I believe in your book you mentioned that Microsoft is working with Docker to create some sort of integration.
Yes, next version of Windows Server is supposed to support Docker containers. I think they've got some beta stuff working at the moment, but I'm a little bit out of date, so I'm not sure right now what the state of that is. It does sound good going forward because if we can run Windows containers and Linux containers, that basically gives us our entire test stack. I mean, okay, we won't have OS X containers, but realistically, OS X isn't usually used in the wild for as a server that most people host their stuff on. Used in laptops quite a bit, yeah, but not as a server.
And Mike, also in your book, you have a chapter on exceptions are actual oracles. And once again, a lot of times I work with a lot of teams and for some reason they don't read the exceptions, or when they do, they don't understand it. But I think you outline the most common exceptions you'll encounter with Selenium. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what are exceptions as actual oracles, what you mean by that?
So I guess I mentioned in the book quite a bit. I see an oracle as something that gives you information. So these exceptions are telling you why something's broken or something hasn't worked. So these exceptions are actually trying to tell you how to fix the problem you've got. A lot of people will see an exception, they'll see loads and loads of code, and they'll freak out because there's about 50 lines of code that they don't really recognize, and they won't look at it in any great detail, and they'll just ignore it, and they'll start trying to change things in their code and run it again and see if it fixes it and change it again and again and again. And they don't really know what they're doing. They're just, you know, flapping about like a fish out of water, trying to hope something magically fixes itself. if you actually stop and take a look at the information that these exceptions are giving you, 9 times out of 10, it'll point to an exact line of code where you've got a problem, and it'll give you an exception name that means something very specific that will help you find out what's wrong with your test.
Are there any tips on how to make our Selenium tests more reliable and less flaky? I hear every conference I go to, Selenium tests are flaky, but what does that mean? What do you see as the main causes for this flakiness?
I think the main causes for flakiness is badly written tests, which most people don't like to hear, surprisingly. Selenium's very, very good at what it does. It does have a few quirks, but the vast majority of flakiness you see in tests are waiting problems. So the waiting problems will be that the page isn't in a state that the person who's testing expects it to be in. Or it could be that the page is changing and it's not changed too quickly, or it's changed, not changed quick enough, or it's changed too quickly. Or a lot of the time it's people don't really want the application they're doing is doing under the hood. Sorry, the application they're testing is doing under the hood. So a good example would be things like stale element reference exceptions. When you're writing your automated tests, occasionally you'll get a stale element reference exception. What this means is that you found an element in the DOM of a website, and you're now trying to interact with that element. But since the last time you, since you found that element and the time you tried to interact with it, the code on the web page has destroyed that element, so it's not there anymore. So at that point, you get a stale element reference exception. Now, a lot of people will then go and have a look at the page, and they'll see an element that looks exactly the same. It's in exactly the same place in the DOM, and it's got exactly the same markup. And they'll say, oh, Selenium is flaky. Why has it gone wrong? What's actually happened is that the web page you're testing has destroyed the element, and it's recreated it again. So even though it looks the same, it's a completely different element. But the person that's writing their test hasn't realized that this is what's happened. So they'll start complaining that Selenium doesn't work or Selenium is flaky. What they really need to do is work out what the conditions are for that element to be destroyed, and make sure that whenever that element is destroyed, they try and find it again, or try and find the replacement element. So it's normally knowledge, I guess, really. When you first start doing Selenium, you're not really aware of timeout issues or things like stale element reference exceptions, and the more you work with it, the more you get used to it.
It's actually a great point, and I'm going to have a rant right now, I feel like. It's just that, once again, I work with 8 to 10 Scrum teams, and they're always telling me Selenium doesn't work with our application. And they just do halfway scripts. They don't realize what they're doing. They don't put the effort in. And so what do? They blame Selenium, not their coding skills of how they're creating the test, or even the application. They'll be demoing the application. You'll be seeing these weird pop-ups, and they'll be clicking OK on them. So if you were to actually run an automated test against that, those pop-ups would have killed it. But they blame Selenium. They don't blame the application or what they're doing. It drives me crazy.
It is one of the more frustrating things I see. I can't think of a time when somebody's told me Selenium is flaky where it hasn't been a badly written test.
Oh.
I mean, another reason is very bad locators. If you're writing tests these days, there's very little reason to not get the developers to put in an ID for you to find an element, or to just do it yourself. A lot of people you'll see have written these massive XPaths that are about A4 length bit of paper. And they're insane. You know, XPath is very powerful, but XPath was originally designed for XML documents, not for HTML documents. The way you write an XPath for an HTML document is not the way you'd write an XPath for an XML document, because they're totally different things. XML documents don't change. You know, they've got schemas, they're very static, whereas an HTML page is constantly changing, and whenever somebody does something on the front end, it'll change its structure a bit, and stuff will get added into the DOM, stuff will get taken out of the DOM, the DOM will get manipulated, you know, like attributes will change. You'll get extra classes added to attributes. You've got different colors appearing all over the place. So you don't want really, really long and explicit XPaths. You want very loose XPaths that are finding generic things.
Before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve the Selenium automation efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
I guess, if you want to get really good at any automation, the best thing you can do is learn how to program. I get a lot of people asking me how to get into Selenium or how to start automated testing. And really, you've got to understand how the programming side of it works. Don't use things like the Selenium IDE plugin for Firefox, because that won't generate good code for you. You can't hope to write good scripts if you don't understand the basics of programming. So I think the best thing to improve your automation skills is to improve your programming skills. I'm on Twitter. My hashtag is Ardesco. That's A-R-D-E-S-C-O.
Thank you, Mark, for your Selenium automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/81. And while you're there, make sure to click on the Sign Up Now button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And if this episode has helped you in any way, why not share it with a friend or coworker? And together, we can spread automation awesomeness to the masses. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with test automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.